Good morning. Thanks for Charlotte and, of course, for the Microsofties for intercepting me on the way back home. I got this email literally a few weeks ago saying, could you just stop by and do a tech talk? So what I chose to actually talk with you today about is the service bus. This is actually an excerpt from the PDC session I'm going to be giving, so you literally get PDC content now. That's the good news. The bad news, we can't make any of this stuff work. So what is this service bus? It's actually the first piece of a massive initiative for Microsoft for cloud computing. Strictly speaking, it's not really cloud computing. It's cloud-assisted computing because the stuff still runs on your machines. But it's by far the most accessible, most ready to use, most needed pieces of this puzzle. What does it mean? Eventually, we're all going to be using the cloud. Eventually. What I'm going to show you today, you need yesterday. Okay? Now, while it was designed to address a particular nasty connectivity issue, it turns out that doing things this way has enormous potential in scalability, in availability, in composability of applications, and, of course, security. And so I suspect this is going to be the predominant way of connecting virtually any kind of application, even eventually intranet. I know it doesn't make any sense, but you will see it later on. So why do we even need it? The reality is web services suck. Yes, they suck royally. And I know it goes against the grain of whatever Microsoft has been preaching, but they absolutely suck. And none of you is actually using a web service. No, you do something else. Nobody ever dares expose an object to the web. That's suicidal. You erect barriers to communication. You never connect a client directly to your precious object somewhere in the internet. No, at the very least, you have some kind of a software firewall behind your operating system, typically behind some kind of a hardware firewall, which is, of course, behind some kind of a GHTTP, behind some kind of a router, which means the address for this service is 192.168.1.1 means nothing. Maybe there's some kind of network segment you have to do translation. In fact, your IP is really 1.2.3.4, which actually doesn't mean anything. And then maybe some kind of a load balancer. And then you get some address from some kind of an internet provider. And you could be running inside a virtual PC on top of that. In fact, we're moving into a world where everything is going to be virtualized. I'm running right now inside a virtual PC. So pray tell, how could this client actually find this object? The short answer is, it never does. You never actually do just that. Instead, you do something else. You put this object maybe in a DMZ. Is a DMZ a true web service? No, it's somewhere in between the web and your real service, and you accept the call, and if you authenticate it, then you start managing the credentials of the user inside the DMZ, and if you take that and actually make another call into the internet using another kind of credentials, then you have identity propagation issues, of course, what kind of security you're going to do, what do you do with authorization, is that another issue. And that, of course, if you know what you're doing, most people don't. As a result, they typically may have some kind of a gaping security hole inside the DMZ, they don't actually know about it. You think you have a DMZ, you don't. You have a direct conduit into your system. Wonderful. And maybe you try and say, well, I'm going to use some kind of a static IP. Do we have enough static IPs for every object on the planet? Because that is really what it takes, by the way, to do a true web service. Maybe you're going to use some kind of DNS or dynamic DNS, but then it's not really real time. You have to constantly keep updating it and publish your real addresses, and then calls fail. And it's a big, ugly mess, right? And if you think this is a problem, how about this case? What if the object wants to call the client? Now, it turns out callbacks is a really hardcore business scenario. We really want to be able to call back to the client and update it about something that happened on the service. But now all the barriers of communication are erected on the client side. Now, you may have enough IT muscle to pull this. How are you going to do this for every button on every Windows form somewhere? How is that going to happen? And who's going to manage it? In fact, this is such a bad situation, nobody has ever even tried to standardize it. There's a bunch of WS-TAR standard that says how you do this. Okay, maybe, but there wasn't even an attempt to standardize this code. Oh, this is too hard, we're just not going to do it. And so people do all sorts of weird things. They do polling from the client, and they've got timers, and what are weird hacks to make this thing work, because nobody really actually is doing a callback. I told you, it sucks. So a guy goes to the doctor and says, "Doc, it hurts when I do that." What will the doctor say? "Don't do that." Yes, I have a very simple solution. Don't do this. This is horrible. In fact, I've been saying it for years. I've been saying for years, don't use web services. Anybody heard me saying that thing? Anybody? Show of hands. Anybody? You see, I'm not making it up. I've been saying it for years. I've been very consistent. So, don't do that. Instead, there's another design pattern. Basically, you design around this problem. And what you need to do, how about you avoid ever connecting the clients directly to the service? Instead, you use a relay service. And you put the relay service in the cloud. Why the cloud? The cloud is neutral. It's neither good nor bad. Both the client and the service can authenticate against the cloud. And then, using some advanced network trickery and some technology, you can actually forward the call to the service. So the pattern would look like this. The client never connects to the service. Instead, there's a relay service in the cloud. The first thing that happens, the service wakes up, calls out through the barriers of communication to the relay service and says, "Hello, I'm here, let me in." Now it turns out in most environments, they will let you call out. It's the calling back that there's a problem with, but calling out. If you can open a browser, you're calling out. Doesn't matter how many barriers you have, you can still call out. It turns out this call out contains enough traces of the original location, coordinates of this object, for the relay service to actually figure out where this object really is. Now, when it calls out, it authenticates against the relay service and says, "Look, here's who I am, and I'd like to receive calls." Sometimes later, the client connects to the relay service and says, "I'd like to connect to the service." The relay service now authenticates the client and then forwards the message from the client to the service. And that would solve it. Now, you've all been doing this, but you haven't even been realizing you're doing this. We're all using Skype, right? Well, this is really what Skype is doing. How could it possibly be that you can run the Skype applet on your machine and then talk to anybody on the other side of the planet? Just click, click, and you open a connection. How could it possibly be? Because that's basically what you're doing. You're doing something else. I'll show you what that something else is when we talk about hybrid mode, but that's what Skype is. It's a relay service in the sky for phone calls. So it's clearly possible to solve this problem. In theory. In practice, it's not so easy because it requires an enormous amount of networking know-how to do this. In fact, let's try and quantify it. eBay paid $4 billion to buy Skype. Now, they probably overpaid. Maybe they should have paid $1 billion. Put differently, eBay valued the know-how of doing this at $1 billion. Do you have network geeks so smart they're worth $1 billion working for you? Probably not. The reality is that while this is technology feasible, the bar is set very high. Regular developers don't know enough network programming to do this kind of a thing. Now, when Microsoft looked at this problem, it said, fundamentally, there's nothing here which is specific to any application. Let's commoditize it. Let's do what they call Skype in a box. Now, some 2 years ago, when the team first tried to describe to me what they were doing, they literally said, "We're trying to do Skype in a box." Now, they will never make that statement today. In fact, they went far above and beyond a mere relay. You will see that later on. But that was the intent. A relay and a shrink wrap. And that's basically what the .NET Service Bus is all about. The first step in realizing what it is, you can say it's a relay service, it's a DMZ in the sky, allowing you to do this kind of a bouncing. There's additional benefits doing it this way. First of all, nobody actually sees your service. All they see is the endpoint of the relay service, which means there's no way a malicious client can go and attack your service, ever. All of the denial of service attacks, all of the replay attacks, all of that nastiness is against Microsoft, not against you. And presumably they know how to actually repel those things. Think about it, how protected you are now. In addition, this is typically hosted in a massive data center. In fact, Microsoft is now in the process of buying 10 data centers all over the world at $500 million a piece. Think about that for a second. And you get to leverage that kind of an IT budget. Now, you don't need $5 billion of IT infrastructure every day, but suppose you do, even for a second. Right? So you can leverage an enormous amount of infrastructure that there's no way that a little guy can actually afford to have. And the classic scenario in the 90s was there's two guys working in a garage somewhere, and they really have got a cool idea, and then try and sell it to some behemoth, some big company, and they say, oh, we expect this kind of level of service, but your application, it's a desktop over there underneath the garage. We're not doing business with you. And you don't have the money to actually do a proper IT job, but now you do. That's kind of like the whole promise of cloud computing in general. But you can leverage this immediately. Now remember, you're still writing this code, you're still writing this code. It's just this piece that somebody gives you. And so beyond solving the connectivity issues, there's fundamental benefits in security and in scalability. And that's kind of like out of the gate. When Microsoft looked at it, they also said, let's choose WCF as the programming model. In fact, if you know WCF, you already know how to program against a service bus. How many of you know WCF? Good. Those who don't, maybe we can get them some crayons, maybe. Okay. Most of this goodness comes from a single DLL called the Service Model Service Bus. Right now, the namespace is Microsoft Service Bus. That will change in a single DLL. The relay currently support reliable messaging and message security and transport security. It does not support end-to-end transactions. That will likely change in the next release. Now, there's a little bit of a problem here, which is kind of like the only difference between conventional WCF programming and the service bus programming. It's actually not necessarily WCF itself, it's the hosting environment. Normally in WCF, the service has to be running before the client makes the first request. There has to be somebody at the end of the wire accepting the call. Now, if you're doing self-hosting, you're the one launching the service host, and that's fine. If you're using the WAS, the Windows Activation Service, then the first client request will be intercepted by the WAS, which will make it launch a worker process to launch your service to actually accept the call. But remember, what is step one of this? The service calls out, which means as things stand right now, you cannot use the WAS. I find it a bit ironic that the premier way of hosting a web service, the Windows Activation Service on Windows 2008, cannot use this. So about a year ago, I complained to the team. I said, you know, you can't use the WAS. I said, yes, you can. I said, no, you can't. I said, yes, you can. I said, you know, what? Can you show me how to do it? They said, well, I said, what was that? They said, blah, blah, blah. So I haven't seen the new bits of Dublin, but supposedly in Dublin there will be the Yuval checkbox, which will be start this process immediately. Kind of like prime it up, launch it, just so we can do this kind of a thing. Okay. So unless you're using Dublin, you're basically restricted for using self-hosting, even if you're running on Windows 2008. Okay. So if you want to hedge your bets, always use self-hosting here. Now, the bits are a bit in flux. In fact, November 5th is today, and today the cloud goes down. And it's going to come up over the weekend with the bits to be released at the PDC. And that kind of explains why we can't do any of the demos. Okay? On top of that, there's some flux in a term. You have to kind of like register with a service bus. Now, just like when you open a new company and you register a URL, you have to basically register a domain. And so in the old bits, the domain was called a solution. In the new bits, the team calls it a domain, the portal calls it namespace, and the APIs call it a solution. One of these three is going to win. I don't know which one is which. I think domain is a good name, so I picked domain for my PDC slides. I asked the team the day before which one is it. They said, we don't know. So let's call it a domain. You have to register a domain. And what is a domain? It's equivalent of a machine name or a URI in the internet world. Any available string will do. Okay. So you go to the service bus portal, you register a domain. Every service bus service has to have an address with the following format, a base address and any number of optional URIs. The format of the base address is some kind of a transport schema and then a domain name and then servicebuswindows.net. The schema can be SB for service bus or HTTP or HTTPS. Which one is it? Depending on the binding you're going to use. Here's a number of service bus addresses. This is just the base address without any URI. It's just fine. Or you can say my service or my endpoint. And virtually anything you like. It doesn't matter at all. It's just a string. The important thing is that this domain thing is going to be available to you. Here is it with HTTP. Now, what you actually do when you register an address like this, whenever you designate a URI, you launch a listening thread in the service bus fabric to monitor messages heading your way. It actually monitors not just URI, but anything underneath it. And that presents a problem. What happens if two services register an address that has the same URI or the same listening route? So there's a requirement here, which is no address can be the complete prefix of another address. Meaning these two services are actually invalid because this address is the prefix of this address. Okay? Again, kind of similar to regular addresses in the web. Once your service is running, you can choose to publish its presence using an Atom feed. You can open a browser and see the services over there. And I'm just going to try and launch a demo. And what I'm going to be doing here... Huh! It actually worked. I'm surprised. So we got at least one part of the demo going. And the decision to publish to the service registry is optional. There's an enum called discovery type. You can say it's public or private. It's simply an endpoint behavior. What you need to do is kind of like loop around over your host and assign to every endpoint a decision if you want to publish it to the registry or not. Once it's published, you will literally get to see a feed of it. Okay? Now, looking at the browser to see your service is not really a good idea. So I wrote a tool for that. And I call the tool the Service Bus Explorer. And the Service Bus Explorer shows you your Service Bus assets. It can be more than services. In fact, you're going to have much more than services as time goes by. So literally, like File Explorer, but this is the Service Bus Explorer. Okay. Why it was up to me to do it, I do not know. But that's the way things are. There's three bindings you can use for the service bus, which are, let's call it the main bindings. There's a bunch of other bindings, but these are the things you're really, really likely to use. A TCP relay binding, a one relay binding, and an event relay binding. There's another binding called WS2007 relay binding. The likelihood of you actually using it is approaching zero. For the simple reason is the TCP relay binding is, of course, using TCP encoding proprietary to Microsoft, which means the other party has to be also running WCF. But if you turn on every last feature that WCF has to offer, like reliable messaging and message security, WCF is the only game in town anyway that can actually play along those standards. If you're actually relying on the WCF features, in practical terms, you're making a statement, I know the other party is WCF anyway. Why would you ever want to go with the WS relay binding? Doesn't make any sense. At some point, Java land is going to catch up. Who knows when? But if they do, you can actually try and use this binding. Okay. Note, by the way, that even though it says TCP binding, it's not limited for TCP. It can actually even do HTTP over port 80. So you're not even limited in that respect. The TCP relay binding, like I said, is the binding of choice in the vast majority of cases. It gives the best performance, the best throughput. It minimizes the overhead on the service. The binding requires the use of port 808 or 828. There's no limitation on the message size. You can pass the entire Encyclopedia Britannica if you like. It doesn't matter at all. The TCP relay binding is just like regular WCF. You have to have a service running before the client makes the first call, but you can have any number of clients sending messages to the relay, to the service. It maintains a transport session through the relay, which means every time you call, you're going to get the same object on the other side of the cloud. So if I turn around to this demo, which I'm pleased to tell you it actually works. Just the demo gods on our side today. And we're just going to look at what this demo is doing. I have here a form. The form has a label. And I have a counter property which simply goes and updates a label. The service has a counter as a member variable. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to obtain a reference to the form and simply update this counter using the value of this integer. Now, every time there's a call, I'm going to simply read from this member variable and use it. Now, if I'm going to get the same object every time, which is see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right? If I get the same object every time, like with regular web services, I would see 1, 1, 1, 1, right? Let's see what this guy is doing. I basically expose a WCF endpoint, and I'm saying I'd like to use a TCP relay binding, and for the transport, I'm using service bus. And that's practically the only way of telling that I'm not using regular WCF anymore. Okay? And I went with the My Service URI here. Let's see the client. Client is a Windows Form application. And I'm running here on a virtual PC, which means every mouse click takes forever. There we go. And the client is a proxy as a member variable. Every time I click the button, I use the same proxy to issue the next call. Okay? So, here. Clearly, I'm getting the same object. That's what I mean, there's a transport session through the relay. This is just like normal C sharp. You create an object, it's yours, you keep using it. Okay? But let's just talk about what is actually going on here. I'm now running inside a virtual PC. Here, it's a virtual PC. This virtual PC has some kind of an IP address, which is 192.168.164.65. Who gave it this address? The virtual PC console. Right? So if I were to actually look outside the virtual PC, I would go here. Oop, not this one. Nope. This one. This guy, and look at its settings. And we look at network. We see I'm actually using network under translation. In fact, what it means is that I put the virtual PC in a separate network segment. And the virtual PC is now using like a bridge between two network segments into the virtual PC. So the virtual PC is inside a cage, which is in its own network segment. Okay? And the virtual PC is getting its IP from my host PC, which is Vista. And Vista, if we look at the properties here, of course, now there's more clicks because everything's more complicated in Vista, so we kind of like have to drill now and find the IP. It's not going to be as easy. And more clicks here. And we're going to do more clicks here. And we're going to do more clicks here. And now we actually get to see it. Vista, sometimes I call it Vista, got 10.39.28.192, whatever. Okay? Who gave it this IP address? Well, it's getting an IP address from the Microsoft guest network. Okay? And of course, this is not really the real address. This is kind of like a local address from the local area network. Okay? So that's kind of like, let's see what happens every time you jump back to the virtual PC. Let's just talk about what happened every time I click this button. I click this button on the client. The client calls out through the XP firewall inside my virtual PC, through the bridge in the virtual PC console, through the Vista wireless network card, into this building router, into the local Denmark cloud. Now, the service bus right now is actually running in a data center in Dallas, Texas. So over the Atlantic, bypassing Greenland, into the East Coast, into Dallas, find the service bus, turn around, go over there, find the URI, and then start the journey back. So from Dallas, Texas, back through the fiber optics under the Atlantic, back into Denmark, find the Microsoft building, find the local network, find the local router, find the host PC, which is Vista, okay? Punch through each firewall into the local virtual PC, through the network bridge, punch the XP firewall, find the same object, and increment it. And every time I click this button, this is exactly what takes place. Think about it. This is adequate for highly interactive applications. Okay? And this is actually the slow mode of the TCP relay service. And this is... and there's another thing that's actually interesting here, which is The service bus is so highly optimized, I actually tested it, and the delay here is about 70% the speed of light. I mean, clearly there's only so much you can accelerate between here and Texas and back, right? But you can measure it, and I did. And it's 70% the speed of light. But wait, there's more. The service bus doesn't play by regular rules of computing. What does it mean? In normal machines, scalability times throughput is a constant. What does it mean? I can take a laptop, and I have some kind of a service, and I'm banging on it with a client. Suppose I'm doing 100 calls per second with a single client. What if I launch four clients against the same machine, and we do 25 calls per second? More or less, right? Scalability times throughput is always a constant on any machine. The service bus doesn't play along. The latency is the same if you have one client, 100 clients, 10,000 clients, or 100 services, 10,000 services, and I tested it. Which means suppose you have, say, 500 services or 500 clients that need to be notified about something that happened on your service, some kind of an event perhaps. Normally, if you try and do it using regular C#, you would do some kind of a for each, right? You have to. Now, if you do some kind of a for each, then the first one is going to get it a lot sooner than the last one. And sometimes this end-to-end time may be unacceptable for your system. You say, well, I have to publish concurrently. You say, oh, I publish concurrently. What if you have 10,000 of them? Do you want to launch 10,000 threads? What will that do to your machine? Okay? So you have to do some kind of a pooled mechanism where you start multiplexing the publishing of the threads from the thread pool. But even that is not guaranteed because the pool is actually capped at 20, 30, 40, whatever the number is. If you have 10,000 services to notify, there will be some kind of a latency here. The service bus has no latency. I don't know how they're actually doing. There's a bunch of patents behind the covers to make it actually work, but that's what they do. So the time it takes to actually notify one service, notify 10,000, will be exactly the same. Services are not doing for each inside the service bus fabric. There's a kind of conversion to UDP and do some other things. I don't really care how they do it as long as they're actually doing it. And this tells me that over time, people are going to start using it even in intranet environments because of the ability to have instantaneous access to multiple endpoints. I'm almost hesitant to actually close this demo because it's the first time it actually worked. Let's just keep it running. Yeah, close it. I should have actually launched the Service Bus Explorer. So let me just do one more thing here. Let me launch the Service Bus Explorer. Let me explore the solution or the domain here. And here's my service running on the service bus. Okay? So let's really close it now. Now, the relay binding comes in two flavors. There's a relayed mode and a hybrid mode. The relay mode you've already seen. The hybrid mode does the following. It starts like relayed, and the service calls out, and at this point, the relay service already knows the coordinate of the object. When the client connects, the relay service says, look, I already know where this object is. Here's everything you need to know to talk to it, and the client talks directly to the relay service now. It's as if you're running now that piece of code that executing here, you're actually running now inside your client. Okay? That, by the way, is actually what Skype is doing. Whenever you launch Skype and it says you have 14 million concurrent call calls now running on Skype, that's baloney. No server in the world can do 14 million concurrent phone calls. Okay? All Skype is a dictionary. When you connect to Skype from your applet, Skype figures out where you really are. When somebody wants to talk to you over Skype, they ping the Skype dictionary, pick up your coordinates, and establish a peer-to-peer connection. It doesn't cost Skype anything to have 14 million versus 16 million concurrent phone calls. It doesn't matter to them at all. My laptop can do Skype. It's a table, and just a hash table, just get the username, get the coordinate. That's all Skype is. Then the billing and everything else, but fundamentally, that's what it is. Okay? Now, sometimes this kind of a connection is not possible. In some restrictive environment, you cannot run Skype, right? So in IT environments where the IT administrator is playing God and is blocking all the ports, he won't be able to run the service bus this way. Litmus test is, do they allow you to run Skype? And I found that there's enormous affinity between the two. Environments that allow you to run Skype will allow you to run hybrid mode as well. So what the relay binding will do is, if promote is not possible, you will stay relayed. But if promotion is possible, it will promote you to direct. They will also negotiate the most intimate scope. What does it mean? If these guys are truly on the other side of the cloud, then you really need full-blown internet coordinates. But if these guys are in the same intranet, why go to the cloud to come back to the same intranet? So it will give you same intranet coordinates. And if these guys are on the same machine, why go to the network in the first place? And a hearsay is that they're actually going to open up an IPC connection in this case. They're even talking about in future releases optimizing it on the same machine so that if you're in the same process, they can optimize that as well. Okay? Conceptually, all you need to do is you configure the binding just like any other flag in the binding, so I'd like to get hybrid. Now, hybrid should have been the default of TCP, but relay is the default of TCP. Why is that? Because hybrid requires message security. If you're connecting through the relay, then the relay can actually do transport security from here to here and from here to here. But if you're connecting directly here to here, they don't trust you to do transport security properly. And so they require message security here. Okay? There's also issues with promotion. It's easier to promote something which is already secured. Okay? Now, configuring message security is an arm and a leg in any environment. Now, I have helper classes that streamline it, but it's still not the default. If they were to choose hybrid, the TCP relay binding will not work out of the box by default. By choosing relay, it always works by default, but it's not the optimized mode. The TCP relay binding also supports duplex callbacks through the relay, which means the service can go through the relay and call back to the client. The syntax and everything else is just like regular WCF. You can't tell them apart. And I'm going to show you the code, and I'm going to try and show you the demo, but I'm going to first show you the code. I don't know if the demo is going to work. I have a contract. I define a callback contract. The service is going to turn around, grab a reference to the callback contract, and turn around and call it. That's it. Let's look at the service, at the client. The client is a Windows form. It supports the callback contract directly on the form. It calls out. While it calls out, a callback is going to come in. I'm going to show a message box here. Okay. If the demo doesn't work, you just can talk about it, right? We'll see. There's enormous delays now as they're taking down the old cloud. It's kind of funny saying the old cloud. It's the old cloud. Okay. The WS relay binding is supposedly for interoperable HTTP requests. Now, you don't have to have HTTP requests. You can also do HTTP over the TCP relay binding, but supposedly, if we have a Java application that needs to talk strictly over HTTP with WS reliable messaging and such, you would use that binding. By and large, don't hold your breath. Okay? Javelin doesn't support these things yet. Same limitation on hosting, the service must be running before, and so on. Okay. How are we doing on the demo? Not so good. This is going to time out. Okay. The one relay binding is interesting binding that has no equivalent in regular WCF LAN. In regular WCF LAN, the client makes a call, and if there's no service, the client gets an error. Always. And the TCP relay binding, and also WS relay binding, will mimic that. If no service is monitoring the URI you send messages to, you're going to get an exception. The one-way relay binding does something else. The client deposits the messages into a buffer in the cloud and returns. If a service is monitoring that buffer too, the relay service will pick it up from the buffer and give it to the service. But if no service is monitoring it, it's going to take the message, Toss it. Never happen. So it's the only bank that supports an unknown service state. Obviously, you can't assume any guarantee of delivery, any order of delivery, and everything else. Now, because they're actually buffering up the message, they could be susceptible now for some kind of a denial of service attack when somebody is trying to send them the entire Encyclopedia Britannica in every message and basically causes a buffer overflow on their side. They're actually going to cap the messages here. In the current bit, it's about 60 or 64K. They're talking about extending it to 128, probably going to 256 at release time. But it won't be megs, okay? It can't be. Now, normal business invocation messages are absolutely minuscule. They're tiny, 1K, 4K. You're not going to need that much anyway. And in general, it's a bad idea to start shuffling enormous amounts of data between two ends of the system. So keep the data where the data is and manipulate it where it is using logical operation. That's always a good design idea. So I'm not that concerned about the limitation here. You shouldn't actually ever reach a limitation. You basically say SB for service bus, one way relay binding, you're actually done. Okay? And how are we doing over here? Yeah, we timed out. Let's just try and run this demo and see if that works. Actually, because it's one way, I don't have to actually wait for the service to build. I can just fire the call. Here's it's one way, SB. Let's keep talking. Okay. The event relay binding is a specialization of the one-way relay binding. It derives from it. It's exactly the same in every absolute respect. Yeah. Not good. Except the event relay binding allows any number of services to monitor that buffer in the cloud. So you can have any number of clients posting to the buffer in the cloud. What you have here is N2M communication, where both N and M can be zero or infinite. Nothing else in WCF LAN gives you this multiplexing ability. Now, the service has to open an event relay binding endpoint. By opening the event relay rather than the one-way relay, you're saying, okay, I'm a good neighbor here. I'm okay with others monitoring the same buffer. The client can still use the one-way binding just to post the messages. Doesn't really matter. If you use the event relay binding, you stop treating the service bus as a relay service and instead start treating it as an event hub. Now I'm using it not as an ability to relay messages, although that takes place as well, but as a way of multiplexing messages in a way that you simply cannot do on your own. And a classic example is those 10,000 subscribers that you could have. So you could have any number of publishers firing an event to a number of subscribers. This can really be a really, really big numbers, but end to end, you will see the same latency. And this makes for some phenomenal demos, but yeah. I mean, we can still try. Let's just try. May or may not work. Who knows? Okay. And yeah. Well, they're changing the cloud today. Probably right now, so. Right? What can we do? Now, how much time do we have? I don't know if I want to go into this particular nastiness. Yeah. So that actually there's a wonderful demo I wanted to show you, but I still can't even do that. I have a little applet that shares my clipboard over the cloud. And that means you do copy in one machine, paste in another machine. Machines have never heard about each other. You can transfer files this way, text, whatever you like. Makes for a nice demo, but can't do the demo. Okay. So in the remaining of the time, I'm going to try and show you some current and upcoming features of this technology. Okay? So the first interesting thing is that here's the WCF architecture of a regular WCF core. Normally, WCF is always in between the client and the service. It installs this massive interception chain. The client talks to the proxy. The proxy converts the client call to a WCF message, running to a set of interceptors to do some kind of pre-call processing, things like encoding the message, putting transaction in the message, encrypting the message, and so on. Into the channel, up the other side, you do post-call processing, pre-call processing on the host side, decrypting the message, decoding the message, doing logging, synchronization, session IDs. Dispatcher converts the WCF message into a call stack over C# and calls the object. Okay? And then when you return, everything kind of like unravels on the way out. Okay? That is indeed the WCF architecture, but let me suggest to you this is actually a very detailed design view of that architecture. If you want to talk about architecture as opposed to little design, the architecture actually looks like this. Right? WCF injects a kind of middleware between the client and the service. What exactly is that middleware? Well, I mean, you know, read my book. It talks about these things. But conceptually, the architecture looks like this. And all the added value of WCF, the transaction, the security, the reliability, synchronization, logging, all of that is done using that middleware in between. Let me also suggest to you that the diagram I showed you before about the service bus is merely another kind of middleware between the client and the service. So conceptually, the architecture of the service bus looks like this. It's also middleware between the client and the service. Only difference is this middleware is not residing on-premise on your machine. It's somewhere in the cloud. So let me suggest to you that from an architecture standpoint, this and this is actually the same diagram, right? And that's a very interesting observation, because what it means is that you can start treating the cloud as the ultimate interceptor. Why is that? When you're doing things like this in WCF, everything in WCF, everything in the extensibility APIs, is all about trying to make those interceptors be absolutely feather light. Ding! Quick, quick, quick! I don't want to pay for that. Maybe I can squeak some more, right? Because on every call, you're going to be paying for jumping to some 32 stops in this pipeline. This pipeline has 32 stops in it. And when you interject some code here, be it transaction or logging or security, you want to make it as least intrusive as possible. Right? But if your interception looks like this, there's enormous latency going from here to here and from here to here. You'll be paying for that latency anyway, which means whatever you do here counts less. Which means you have the option of being far more aggressive here than you can ever be here. Because nobody would care. If they're already willing to pay for that, eh. It's a few more armchairs on the deck of the Titanic. It doesn't really matter. Right? And since here you can put a lot of additional hardware and machines, that means you can do more stuff that would just be impossible to think of in this scenario. And this tells me that over time, we're going to see the relay service evolving as the ultimate interceptor, and you would be using it even in most intimate intranet scenarios. If bandwidth and performance is good enough, you'll use it. And if what I showed you before with that click and the label changes, is that good enough for you? You can inject mountains of code now in between. Now, this is my opinion on where this technology is going. It's not Microsoft in any way, shape, or form. I'm just, as an architect, extrapolating what I see as what will happen over time. Now, one of the key pieces of this interception is that when I showed you a URI in the address, you can start treating each URI as a messaging junction and put some logic inside that junction that does certain things. In the bits that the cloud has right now, there's two kinds of interception you can put queues and routers. Those things will die later today, or maybe they're dying right now because they're already changing the service bus. In the PDC bits, you're only able to use buffers, and they're going to put routers and queues and more in the second release of the service bus. Okay, this is going to be actually the first PDC where I'm going to be taking away features in my presentation. And why are they taking away those features? Partly my fault. I poked lots of holes in the routers and routers in security and routers and queues. And the impression I got, they simply don't have enough manpower for all the testing of all those cases. So instead of biting more than they can chew, they decided to drop these things from the first release, put a decent architecture in, enable them to support it and test it in the future. Okay? So I'm going to show you what's going to happen in the first release, and I'm going to talk about what happens in future releases. And then if you have time, we'll talk about some security issues. Okay? So what you could do is you could have each UI actually act as a buffer. Now, the buffer here is different from the buffer of the one-way call. The one-way call I showed you is if nobody's monitoring that buffer, they take the message, drop it on the floor. Never happened. This buffer is kind of like a queue. It stays there. Now, not forever, you can configure how long it stays there, but what you could do is you could actually do queued calls over the cloud, or approximate it. Now, these are definitely not queues in the sense that the current bits of the service bus have, and not queues in the sense that the second release of the service bus is going to have. First of all, these queues are non-durable, which means if there's a catastrophic failure on the service bus, you will lose those messages. Those queues are non-transactional. The messages don't last long. They can only store it for you for 10 minutes. You know why it's 10 minutes? It's because we have 10 fingers. Okay, they have to pick a number. Okay, it's not going to be the number that's adequate for your application. Maybe you want to queue it for a day or a week. No, you can't do it. It's not really queues. There's also a limit of 50 messages in each buffer. In the current bits, by the way, it's max int, okay? So literally as much as you like. And another reason, even though I don't have it explicitly on the slides, is I had quite a few interesting talks this week with the team on the pricing model for the service bus. And I was very critical about the current pricing model, and so I offered them two additional models, and we discussed it. And I think they're going to announce something in the PDC. I don't even know what that something is going to be. But one of the things I discussed with them is that truly long-lasting queues change the pricing model, because now you're going to have to be charged for storage as opposed to connection or messages or whatever pricing model they will come up with. And they simply don't have the ability to do that right now. So they're not going to do it. But that will change over time. So is it queued calls over the web? No. What does it really do? Suppose you have chunky calls. I'm not doing lots of chatty calls. Ta-ta-ta-ta. No, just every once in a while I'm making a call, so the limit of 50 messages in the buffer doesn't really affect me. The application is mostly connected, but maybe on a shaky network. I'm picking the connection, I'm dropping the connection, I'm picking the connection, I'm dropping the connection. Then, you know, being able to kind of like buffer things is a good idea. It also aims at one-way calls. There's no way of getting results of the invocation from the service. Some things, the buffer address must be unique. It must be over HTTP or HTTPS. The API is very similar to sysinput messaging. So what the team did, they took the API of using raw WCF messages, raw MSMQ messages, and moved that to the cloud. Anybody did system.messaging programming? Classic system.messaging, .NET? Yeah. So they basically took that API and moved it to the cloud, which means you have to interact with raw WCF messages. And all messages have to be one way. You can't get results or errors or callbacks. You have to create some kind of a policy to administer the buffer. Out of the box, it requires you writing some code. There's a class called buffer policy, lots of properties, discoverability, expiration, how many messages, what to do if there's an overflow, what kind of transport protection do you need for the messages. And just skip through all of that. And you need to write some code using a class called message buffer client, where you get to create a message buffer given a particular policy, or get a client against a particular buffer, or delete the buffer. And you're kind of like, write some kind of code to do this kind of a thing. And I have a helper class that kind of like streamlines this goo. And also incorporate that in the Service Bus Explorer. So you can go to the, well, you can't because I can't demo it, but if you go to Junction, I allow you to actually create a buffer, give it a name, some properties, create, I'll create a buffer for you. Once it's there, I'm allowing you in the Service Bus Explorer to drill into a particular buffer. You can update certain properties, reset it to its default properties, or delete it, or even purge. As I don't have a purge method, so what I'm doing is I'm recording the current policy, turning around, deleting the queue, deleting the buffer, inserting it back again with the old policies. And that effect is purging the buffer. Right? Now, the programming model is very, very raw. It requires you to interact with raw messages. You can say send, and you send an actual WCF message. You can say retrieve, and you get a message. And this literally forces you to work with raw messages. The programming model is like this. You do some authentication, and then you compose a message, and you put some things in it. And to read it, you get the message, and you retrieve it, and you start passing it. If they were to put an effort into it, they would not be able to come up with an uglier programming model. Okay? Now, I kind of got used to working with things like functions over the last, 35 years? And with objects over the last, 25 years? Or with services over the last 5 years? I kind of missed those things. So I didn't like it. So what you need to do is you need to actually program around it and do conversion between classic invocation on objects and raw messages, and raw messages to classic invocation on objects. And that requires some pretty advanced work. In fact, I rank this kind of a thing as number 4 of all too complicated things to do on my list. Okay, and I was exactly shy of doing complicated things. Okay, so I actually streamlined it. I came up with what I call the Qt Service Bus Host, which derives from Service Host and does this conversion for you. As a construction parameter, you give it a buffer address or any number of buffers to monitor, and you simply open it. That's all you have to do. And it will also do some verification and make sure all the contracts are one way. It will also do security. It will verify the buffers are actually there. One of the things with executing with the current Service Bus buffer is if you post a message to it and the buffer is not there, you're going to get an error. If you try and retrieve a message and the buffer is not there, you're also going to get an error. So what my Service Bus will do, it will actually verify the queues or the buffers. If the queues are not there, before it does anything, it will actually create the queues and have some kind of default policy, which actually maximizes all the values, and on you go. Another thing that you have when you're dealing with buffers, and it's nothing to do with a Service Bus, it's also true of MSMQ, is suppose you're doing some kind of a debug session against calls from the buffer. And you're getting the call from the buffer, you say, ah, I should have done I++. Stop debugging, put the I++, launch it again. And it's doing it like the old time. It's saying, why is it doing that? I changed it, I fixed it. Well, you're getting the messages from the previous debug session, right? So you have to have iron discipline that every time you do stop debugging, you bring up the Service Bus Explorer, you select the queue, and you say purge all, which is why I put that button there. Yeah, right. Of course, you're going to remember to do it every time. So what the Service Bus host will do in debug only is you close the host, will turn around, and purge the queue. Okay. So how is the conversion done? I won't show you the code, just tell you the kung fu that goes on underneath. You give it the service type, here, just like a regular WCF service. What it will do, it will actually host it locally over IPC, over named pipes. You give it a bunch of buffers in the cloud, it would launch a bunch of worker threads. Each worker thread is doing retrieve against each buffer. Every time there's a message, it will do the conversion from a WCF message into an IPC call. So basically, conceptually, what happens here is I'm kind of like interjecting here, taking a message and injecting it into the IPC interception chain, as if it came up over IPC. Of course, it did not. Okay, but I'm kind of like I'm triggering it. And then the rest of the call is regular named pipes. So the service gets the illusion the call was received over regular named pipes. And doing some other things, buffered queued calls don't have a transport session. Every call gets a new object, whereas IPC, every call gets the same object. So I'm also triggering. And that was the issues with Concurrency management, I'm kind of like massaging it all to give you the correct programming model. And that's basically what it's doing here. And also I have a matching proxy class. All you need to do is derive from my queued service client base and basically use it just like a regular proxy. And I'm doing a similar thing. I'm intercepting the call just before they hit the wire on the client side, convert it to a WCF message, and post that to the buffer in the cloud. Okay? Now, because you're pushing it to a buffer in return, there's really no way of getting results or errors out of it. So what you need to do is design around it, and the solution for that is to actually host a second buffer in the cloud where the service is going to respond back to it with the results. And the client is going to have to monitor it using some kind of a client-provided response service. That requires a lot of setup and such. And I have a bunch of feedback classes that kind of like completely automate it. And we don't have time to actually see it because how much time do we have? Not a lot. But I have helper classes that streamline it and automate it to the point you can actually get that scenario working through the service bus as well. Okay? And this is going to get published in my MSDN column sometime beginning of next year. And let me show you one more extensibility point, then we'll talk about security. Okay, so in the current bits, there is routers, but they're going to take it away in the next drop and put it back in the release after that. So I'm going to show you strictly preview of basically two releases down the road. Three if you count the CTP next week. And instead of treating every junction as a buffer, you can treat it as a router. You can give each junction a policy that says how to route messages. Give it to all subscribers, just to one of them, how to give it and everything else. So now you should start treating the service bus as a router. So we've seen the service bus as a relay. We've seen it as an event hub. We've seen it as a queue. Now we see it as a router. And I told you, this is kind of like the ultimate way of starting to extend applications. And doing things this way by intercepting the calls has enormous potential as far as composability and extensibility of applications. And I wish I could do a demo, but that's not going to work. Out of the box, you have to write some code to manage it. I also have an ability to do it in the Service Bus Explorer. You can actually see the existing routers. You can see subscribers for each. You can modify policies, give it to all subscribers, just to one of them. How many subscribers are you actually allowing to have, resetting, updating, and so on. Look at this icon here. Do you know how difficult it is to do meaningful icon in 16 by 16? I spend more time on icon in this tool than anything to do with WCF. And one way of dealing with it is treating a router simply as a router. You take a message and you multiplex it over multiple subscribers. Now, unlike the event relay binding, you can actually install certain policies that says how do you actually broadcast it. The event relay binding is considerably a really dumb router. Always does the same routing. But you can also install a policy that does load balancing. So just give it to one of them. So now I can actually have a load balancer in the cloud. So that's kind of like the fifth use for the service bus, simply as a load balancer. Who needs to invest in an expensive load balancer and dealing with all the sticky IP bits and all that stuff? No, just put it in the cloud. Make sure it gives it to just one of them. What happens is all the services open an endpoint whose address is the router. That's all you have to do. And then one of them will get it when a message comes in. Now, which one is actually going to get it? Well, it depends. Good load balancers do some kind of balanced load balancing, right? I mean, they actually do it in a fair way. So knowing nothing else, people often tend to choose some kind of a round robin. So it's going to be A, B, C. A, B, C. Now, if all things are equal, round robin is actually the best way of doing things. Hardly things are ever always equal, right? So I actually tested what they're doing. They wouldn't tell me what the load balancing algorithm is. So I suspect there's a pending patent on that. But I tested it. And I tested the degree of fairness that they have, and what I found out is that they are 95% round robin. Now, if you think about it, a great algorithm would be a round robin with a scoreboard, the test to see which one of them is actually the most busy, and if it's busier than the others, even though it's then you skip it and you move to the next one. Right? And I was able to actually trigger these things in my testing and actually see that it's not perfect round robin, it's a balanced round robin. Okay? Yes, question? So the question is, can you actually kind of like have sticky where it kind of like remembers this publisher? But you see, that's not the architecture. You can have any number of clients posting to any number of services. And they're not going to keep track here for you. They're not going to do it. For now, there's no routers at all. I mean, let's be thankful for the routers when we're going to get them in the first place. Another thing you can do is you can have one router route to another router. And that actually enables you to, and you can actually do this composing independent of the client or the services. So the services say which router they want to subscribe to. The clients post a particular router, but on the service bus, you start gluing who is routing to whom, which means you do drastic changes to the application without ever affecting the services or the clients. For example, suppose I have services A, B, and C, and I have a requirement that A should always get the messages, and between B and C, I should do load balancing. There is no good way of doing it with a router, with a single router. What you could do, you can have a top router that says, I'm giving it to everybody, and you hook up A directly underneath that, and you hook up another router with a single subscriber underneath that, which does load balancing on B and C. Okay? And you're saying, why would I ever have anything as crazy as that? This is actually incredibly common. I would suggest to you, you will actually want to do it in every application. And the classic example here is logging. Whenever you're doing logging, there's always a problem. There's two problems. First of all, if you're not doing double safe interception, you're going to have to inject in every method of every object logbook.log blah, right? If you want to have a perfect dump of what happened along the call chain, which means, of course, modifying your code. That's not nice. And with WCF, at least you can do some interception-based logging, which means the same client code, but you inject the logbook before or after the call. The problem is that it's highly intrusive. And the more verbose the logging becomes, the more different the code behaves with logging than without the logging. In the classic example, you have some kind of a weird REST condition. You can't really figure it out. You say, let's do some logging. You put the logging, but the logging changes the latency to the point that you can't actually see the REST condition anymore. Right? It happens all the time. And there isn't really a good way of doing that. The third problem with logging is that if you have a long call chain, everybody's doing their logging. That's called discrete logging. They're all doing their own little paper trail of the logging. And now, suppose you have a call chain with seven steps in it. You have seven logbooks. And if you try and picture what is actually going on, you have to integrate in your mind's eye a picture of what actually took place. Right? And the problem now is there is no way of synchronizing all machines down to the last tick. The ticks are so short today, we begin to see relativistic effects between machines. There is no way of synchronizing it. The things may have happened like this, but were actually logged like this. Good luck. Right? So we can solve all three problems by this. You say, look, A is actually a logbook. The logbook always gets the messages. Now, if you always get it like this, there is really no effect to the code inside B and C. There is no latency, and there's no intrusion because you're not really doing anything different here. And the logging done here completely out of order here, but in the right order in which things actually happen. So you're not really imposing any kind of penalty on the services. And you have perfect affinity to the order in which things actually were routed to your system. And you would want to do this kind of a thing a lot. And another use for routers to routers is both the event relay binding and using a router to publish events is that it's very coarse. It's not at the endpoint level. Suppose you have three events, event 1, 2, and 3. And I want to use the router to manage events. And the problem now is, if I only care about event 1, I'm still going to get event 2 and 3, and I have to pay for it, receive it, and toss it internally. Which, of course, since you'll be paying here for messages, first of all, it's going to cost you money to handle messages you don't need, and second, it imposes a penalty on your application. So what you could do is you could actually create a router per operation, and I wish I could show you the demo for that, but imagine that instead of actually having a single router, you have a router for event 1, a router for event 2, a router for event 3. Each subscriber subscribes just for the router they actually care about, per event, and then basically just open and close the appropriate hosts. That would solve that. Now, is routers the classic pub-sub? No. In a classic pub-sub, there's no limit on the number of subscribers. There will be a limit on number of subscribers per router here. The main advantage is the ability to compose here and do it outside the scope of your code using some kind of a tool like the Service Bus Explorer. And I really hope the Service Bus Explorer is not going to be the end-to-all way of managing the service bus, but right now it is. One of the things I'm doing in the service bus to manage routers to routers, you can actually create a router and then drag and drop it on another router, and I would establish a subscription between those two routers. Yeah, simple things. The next composition is to have a queued router. So what you can do is you can have a queue, not necessarily a buffer, subscribing to a router. And you can have a single buffer or a queue subscribing to multiple routers, and you can have a single router feeding to multiple buffers. Okay? Now you're saying, yes, that's really understandable. I would never do anything as crazy as that. This is actually very useful. And a classic use for it is a queued pub sub. Or put differently, now you start using the relay service as a messaging bus. I know it's called a service bus, but now it really is a messaging bus. Because what happens is you can actually have routers associated with a particular event or particular operation. And then they can actually feed to individual queues. Now, if you want to do queued pub sub, opening just a particular queue underneath the router is not good enough. Because if it's just one queue and a bunch of services monitoring that queue, one of them is going to be the first to grab the message. Nobody else is going to get it. The only way to multiplex it is to actually have each service create its own buffer, its own queue underneath each router, based on its level of topics of interest. And then they open up a host against each buffer. And then you would have the events multiplexed by the router to as many buffers as you need to. And you can do this whole thing in the service bus explorer and create a bunch of buffers and queues underneath the routers and everything else. Okay? So all of that, you know, 2011, whenever it's going to happen. Okay? But I had this whole thing running and working on the current bits. Time. Let's talk about security. Just a little topic. Yes.
Can you give some examples of uses of buffers? Buffers are unstable.
If buffers are? So you're saying should I give an example for a buffer?
Yes.
I can't think of any. I don't think it's a good feature. Did I say it's a good feature? Did anybody hear me saying buffer is a good feature? Never said that. In fact, at the risk of disclosing something, I'll show you a nasty email I wrote to the service bus team saying you're going to give the features that nobody needs instead of the features that everybody wants, which is queues. I don't think buffer is a good idea. We couldn't do it. So, didn't do it. I mean, I gave you kind of like the scenario, chunky calls with connectivity issues, maybe. I mean, you can come up with a scenario where you're going to use it, but it's not really queued calls. Now, queued calls over the cloud is something which most application needs. But if you look at the way people are using the web today, very rarely do you see people using the web as an inline integrated part of the call chain. They typically use the web as a way of segmenting logical parts of business workflow that spans perhaps multiple applications and so on. And then you're looking at it as what I'm calling disjoint work, where you have to do a bunch of things, maybe against a bunch of sites, not necessarily right now or in any particular order. And that's perfectly the scenario for queued calls in the cloud. But they don't support it. So let's quickly talk about security. There's two aspects to service bus security. There's authenticating against the service bus, and then there's managing the transfer of the messages end-to-end. The service must always, there's no exception, must authenticate against the service bus. The client, by default, has to authenticate too, but you could exempt the client. Now, in the current bits, they have a nice way of actually having manageable credentials. You can use a password or account space or a certificate. They threw all that away in the CTP bits, and instead they're only doing access control using a shared secret. A shared secret is a 47 long screen, string of just horrible characters. Nobody can actually memorize these things or type it. Okay? It's not intended for human consumption. Will they bring other credentials in the future? Most likely. Why are they doing it now? Because they decided first to go with REST as opposed to what most people actually need. So you go to the portal of your service and you get to create a shared secret. And you can actually have various degrees of roles. You can use the access control. I mean, the access control is actually a really, really nice idea. It lets you separate roles and basically authenticate in order to authorize. It's a nice idea, but by default, you're not going to use it like this. And you simply go and attach behavior to the endpoints of the service or the client that has a particular credential, which is going to be that shared secret. And to make a long story short, the code would look something like this. You create this behavior object, and you stuff the secret in it, and then you loop around over all your endpoints, and you attach it to it. And I was able to actually compress all of that to an extension method to the service host. All you have to do is say set service bus credentials, you're done. Okay? And similar things with clients. Now, the service may actually decide not to exempt the client from service bus authentication, in which case the service must still authenticate the client. And there's some more flags you can actually get that to do, except at this point, the service bus will funnel your way even unauthenticated calls. And if somebody's mounting a denial of service attack against your address in the service bus, you will get all those calls, which is not a good position to be at. Okay? And it gets really interesting when it comes to, so to make a long story short, always authenticate the service and the client. Kind of like that's obvious what you want to do. The problem you're going to run into is that if it's a service box, that there's no UI and it's some kind of a service rack and you own the box, hard coding that horrible string, putting it in a config file is not a big deal. And you can easily put it, where is it? You can easily put it in a config file. It would look like this. You're saying, here's a shared secret, blah, 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 here it is, and that's fine. But this is the last thing you want to do if you deploy your client on some laptop that somebody's going to use, because then it's like putting a password in a config file. You should never do that, right? And you can't really do some kind of a login dialogue because no human will ever be able to type these things or memorize it. They might as well put some kind of a sticky tag on the monitor to actually type it, right? And putting it in the code is no good unless you obfuscate your code. But even that is not good because there's good deobfuscator that actually would pick these things, right? So you may want to do maybe some kind of a wicked data access protection API where you take a piece of the registry and you encrypt that and then you use a password to actually go on that and you have to kind of an encrypted dictionary that maps a user credential to kind of say, I mean, it's not comfortable to do these things. And in the current release, my opinion, not Microsoft's opinion, is that this is not a good solution. They do not accept my opinion. Okay. They still want me to present on the PDC, and I'm still going to say it sucks. Okay. It gets really interesting when it comes to transfer security. Transfer security deals with how do you securely transfer the message through the service bus between the client and the service. This is completely independent from how you authenticate. And I'm absolutely convinced that over time we'll see better solution than that horrible 47 characters solution. We will see better things like card space or password or certificate. There's none, which means no protection. Transport, message, or mixed. It's basically a property of the binding. You get to configure it. If you go with transport security, then with TCP, you would use some kind of SSL. HTTP, you would use HTTPS. It's by far the simplest and easiest mechanism to use. It's a default of the bindings. You never have to do anything else. Now, if you're using transport security, you literally do nothing. You just open an endpoint, doesn't matter which binding, and then automatically establish a secure connection against the relay service from the client to the relay and from the service bus relay service to the service. So that's going to be absolutely secure. The problem is whatever happened inside the relay service is completely in the open. And that means, in theory, Microsoft can eavesdrop on the communication or even tamper with the messages. Now, not in theory. What's in practice? In practice, it's not going to happen. Here's why. I'll give you my opinion why it's not going to happen. Can you imagine once this is deployed, how many messages are going to be running through this? The volume of messages? And there's no way that unless you deploy dedicated hardware with dedicated archiving and dedicated algorithm that parse and look for certain keywords, you can actually make sense of the data or modify it in real time. And this is not something that a rogue employee can actually inject. You see, Microsoft is not the NSA. The NSA is doing that to every email on the planet, right? And the Danish Secret Service is doing it right now to me in my hotel. You know that, right? How many of you know that? Yes, okay. So those guys are doing it. That's not Microsoft. They're not doing it. Now, going after the service bus to eavesdrop on communication is really, really exotic. There's a far lower hanging fruit, which is Windows itself. If they wanted to spy on you, they could be spying on you in Windows right now. As many as they are Microsoft bigots, nobody has ever made the claim that Microsoft is spying on its customers. Anybody ever heard that statement? People hate Microsoft. They would love to make that statement nobody ever made. Which tells me Microsoft as a company has the highest integrity. It's not going to do it. It's not going to deliberately at least go and do it. Which still leaves the option of the rogue employee. However, I know the guy who wrote this code. It's my friend Clemens. And Clemens is a really nice guy. And I know he's not going to do it. So I have kind of like this inside knowledge that this is not going to happen. Message security means you take the entire message, you encrypt the whole thing, and send it to the relay service. Now, there may be some more steps required to actually do it, like installing certificates and validating certificates and configuring identities. But by and large, it will work. And now what would happen is there's this encrypted blob that travels securely to the relay service. Inside, it's still an encrypted blob. And out again, still an encrypted blob. As a result, there's no way the relay service could eavesdrop or modify the message. Okay? So which one should you use? Transport security or message security? You should always go with message security. Don't you dare go with transport security. What's wrong with you? Given the fact that I just said that transport security is good enough, what is going on? Perception is reality. Okay? Now, as an engineer, I can evaluate the situation and say, you know, transport security is good enough. Okay? But I dare you to go and show this diagram to any one of your customers and have him accept it. I'm not going to do that. What is this? What is this? I'm not going to do that. Okay? So in practical terms, we're going to have to go with message security. Okay? So there's really no other option here. And let's just kind of like stop here and take questions. And configuring, by the way, the message security is just like configuring WCF message security, which is still not a walk in the park, but I have attributes that configure the whole thing in Service Model EX, so a little bit easier. Yep. So the question was, you always a transport session, can you still configure the service to be per call? Absolutely. This is just like regular WCF. The session on the transport is completely independent from the context mode of the object. So you can still have a per call service, even though there's a transport session, you still get the same context, you still get the same connection, but you get a new object every time. Now with TCP relay binding, there is no other configuration. There's always a transport session. You can then choose if you want to have the same object or not. With a WS binding, it's more complicated because on a WS binding, if you have message security or reliability or both, you will have a transport session as well. So it behaves like TCP. But if you turn off message security and turn off reliability, there will be no transport session. You always behave per call, even if you configure it to be per session. But that's, again, just like regular WCF. So it's no different at all. More questions? So the question is, are customers going to like Microsoft switching the cloud? Well, what's happening right now is simply because it's a technology preview state. It's not a release product. They will never, ever, 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 ever do this kind of a thing when the system is deployed. So that's not going to happen. If someone is dropping an atom bomb on Dallas, it's going to happen. But short of that, you know, it's not going to happen.
So I think that all the essential part of your client server knowledge communication between your server and client never happened in the future?
So the question is, do I see that in the future people owning their own data centers and investing in IT? This has nothing to do with the service bus. Right, the service bus, like I said, is not really cloud computing. Okay, it's cloud-assisted computing. You still create the client, use it, own it. You still create the machines for the service, use it, own it. It's just that the connectivity is using something very different than what you used to have before. Hold on a second. Conceptually, it's the evolution of a simple DNS server. Whenever you say, I'm going to go to www.google.com, your laptop doesn't know what www.google.com. It goes to DNS services. That's really IP blah, 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 and you go and ping that IP, right? It's exactly the same, except now we transform what is a DNS to a whole other notion, and then we put on top of it scalability and extensibility and composability and routers and so on. Now, if I think that eventually what you describe will happen, that depends on how Azure is going to be adopted over time. And I think over time it's actually going to happen, simply because Microsoft is going to price it, I believe, so aggressively. People are going to find the cost of managing their own IT versus doing it in the cloud, it's going to be a no-brainer, right? And just like people don't write today their own operating system, they used to, but they stopped doing that because Windows is cost-effective enough, right? Then eventually this would happen to IT. Now, the IT guys are going to be kicking and screaming and keep pointing reasons why this is a bad idea. You have any doubt? Anybody has any doubt about that? Okay, so, but you know, I don't see too many, you know, blacksmiths or people who are, you know, using oil from whales for lighting anymore. I mean, certain trades eventually go away. Wagon builders, anybody? Okay, so, I mean, these things eventually go away. More questions? In the back, yeah?
I forget the terminology, but when you showed the diagram of the Relay service, trying to get the client to connect directly to the service, does that then imply the same sort of service risks and sort of the firewall configuration problem that you usually had?
The question was, do we still have the problems of direct connection that all web services have? And the answer is no. The client still has to authenticate against the service bus, so unauthenticated denial of service calls are going to be immediately denied. They're never going to get the chance to be promoted to a direct connection. So that's the attack angle. That's out the window, right? And using the magic of the service bus, there's enough pixie dust in what the client is doing to punch through all those firewalls to actually go to the object. And it's a secure connection because you authenticated it. So it's watertight in that respect. And remember, they're using message security, which means your certificate is securing the message. I mean, that. And if you're saying that this is open, then you could say that WS security, WS trust, WS secure conversation, those things don't work. And we kind of suspect that they do work, so. Well, yes. But even if... but. Some ports have to be open, but if you open port 80, then you should be able to do these things. It's not aggressive. And most environments keep port 818 open as well. So, you know, unless somebody goes and closes these ports, I mean, look, in some environments you cannot run Skype, and we know that's a fact, right? So the litmus test is, can you run Skype? If you can run Skype, then you can do that hybrid connection. If you can't, then you can't. Interesting question. Could you have one client, a client with one particular binding and a service with another kind of binding? And the answer is no, for the same reason you can't have it in WCF. It has nothing to do with the relay service. It's got to do with the binding let the service declare to the world what kind of plumbing it expects. It expects transaction, it expects reliability, it expects security. And if you allow a client to have a different binding, there's no guarantee they're actually going to match up. Now, early builds of WCF in like, you know, we're talking like 2004 now, actually tried to negotiate a subset and open up the subset, but they figured out it's just not worth doing it, and they require complete affinity on both sides. And that makes sense. Yep. When will this technology be ready? Wait for November 17th. They're going to announce it. Ah, great question. So the question was, would it be possible to do your own private cloud in your intranet, right? So suppose you are, you know, a big company and you want to do your own cloud, right? So this has nothing to do with the cloud, right? This is not cloud computing. So there's two questions here, right? Would it be possible to do your own cloud? Would it be possible to do your own service bus? So which one do you want to answer? Your own service bus. I suspect no. I don't think there's any technical limitation. In fact, one of the things that I hope the team will do at some point is, for testing purposes, I'm going to be able to kind of like simulate this whole thing on my laptop, even if I'm working offline, right? And do all my stress testing and so on my own service bus without ever paying for Microsoft for those messages, and then just go and deploy it against the service bus. So it's trivial for purely development purposes to be able to do that. And they told me there's no technical limitation not to do it. It's just a question of how much time they have and testers and resources to actually do it. So will we see that for development purposes? Yes. Will we see it for deployment purposes? I suspect never, on two grounds. First of all, the whole point of doing this is you want to get away from your own intranet and be able to do this kind of a thing. And the second is, how would Microsoft make money that way? Right? So it's probably not going to happen. More questions? Good. Thank you for coming.